Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.
The Joanne O'Riordan Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hello and welcome back to the Joanne O'Riordan Podcast with me, Joanne O'Riordan, on Cork's Red FM. In today's episode, we interview Dr. Katie Liston, who's a senior professor in Ulster University of Jordanstown in the School of Sport, where she focuses on sport and sociology. In this episode, we discuss concussion and everything surrounding concussion, all the myths and everything included, and what it's like to be a man playing in sport today and the manliness and the toxic masculinity that exists in sports today. Thanks very much, Dr. Katie. Would you like to be called Doctor or just Katie?
Katie will do fine, Joanne.
Katie will do fine. How's it going, Katie?
Very well.
Yeah, no, last time I saw you was actually on TV. We shared the same series on TJ Cahir, Manos, Cree. That was an unreal series.
That's right.
So I suppose just kind of looking at your general background in general, you grew up in Limerick, I believe.
Indeed, I'm a bit of a dolly bag mixture, Joanne. I think a lot of people think I'm actually from Kerry, but I'm not. I'm very close to the Kerry border. But I'm born in West Limerick and went to school in Kerry. We were about 9 miles from comprehensive school called Tarbert in North Kerry. And it probably was through my involvement in school. And to be honest, which I suppose I was very lucky that I ended up getting involved in ladies Gaelic football in Kerry. And I kept that on when I moved to Dublin. I got involved in a range of other sports, I suppose, not unlike probably a lot of other women of my generation, soccer and rugby in particular, then maybe weren't played as much around the country as they are now.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting involved in those two when I moved to Dublin. And it sparked an interest for me in, I suppose, the role that sport plays in our lives more generally. So rather than just taking it as a kind of a fun, leisure hobby, or indeed something that's serious, obviously, for professional athletes, I also became much more interested in how it matters to us as an expression of social and cultural values in Ireland. And it was that led me then to start researching it at postgraduate level. And I suppose I've been lucky enough, even though I don't take part anymore, in my head I'm still a top level competitor. My legs tell me otherwise. But then I'm still able to pursue that passion and that interest, I suppose, through my research.
I think that's really cool, because obviously having a background in criminology like myself, when I heard all the studies that you were doing, I was like, yeah, this totally makes sense. Now I can tell people this is why I did the criminology degree in the first place, because everyone kept asking me.
My mother still asks me today, Katie, what is it exactly that you do again? What is sociology? So I always try and kind of get people to think about the function and the value of sport in society, because it's so much more than a game, but also then the importance of picking it apart, digging beneath the surface, because we don't want to take it, I suppose, through rose-tinted glasses either. So like every other aspect of society, I think it merits as much critical analysis as does business, the economy, the arts, and all the other sectors.
Because as I always explain to people, sport at the end of the day, it's like a microcosm of society. It's a small segmented area. And I think anything you see in sport is a reflection of the society itself. So I suppose, you were talking about playing soccer, rugby and GAA. I mean, you played at such a high level. You won All-Ireland. You were player of the match and won All-Ireland, from what I know. So in general, were you always kind of mentally thinking in sociology, or were you just headstrong on playing? You didn't care about the other stuff that was going on outside the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose with the benefit of hindsight, you can always recognize maybe key junctures in your life where that very choice might have arisen, but I didn't maybe recognize it at the time. So I did actually apply for PE at UL and I got it. I took one or two years. I say I took one or two years out. I got a job in Dublin at the time. So I decided I would try and put a little bit of money behind me, because, as you know, it's not easy to put yourself through uni. Yeah. And the more that I was working and thinking about whether I wanted to actually become a PE teacher alongside what was essentially pretty much, 5 or 6 day a week commitment to sport, I thought, I'm not sure it's going to be something that will enable me to maintain that passion for sport, because it would have become a 24/7 pursuit.
Yeah,
I did decide to keep on that job for a while, and I took a little bit more time, and I'd always been interested in social science. While I was working full time, I did a kind of a correspondence course in sociology, and it piqued my interest. So at that point, sports still played an important role, I have to say, in the decision that I took. I decided to go to UCD because I had very fond memories of the track at UCD, which is now gone. It's where we won some of our All-Ireland school medals with Tarbert. And it had a very good reputation in sport, and I wanted to pursue social science at UCD. So it still had a role, sport still had a role in my, I suppose, my academic decision.
Yeah, you know, actually, when I was saying it to a friend of mine who did criminology with me, that, you know, I was interviewing you, and we were kind of not laughing, but we were basically saying, it's so weird, like an athlete is so like headstrong and needs like an A to B to C to D, where sociology is like A to Z with a load of like random lines drawn in the middle. So how, yes, like how, like what dragged you into kind of, like what was your interest? Like, I know you were saying it's a reflection and everything else, but like, was there anything that kind of dragged you in more to sociology?
There was, Joanne. It was the inequalities faced by women in sport, because that was the topic that took me into research at postgraduate level. So that's what I did my PhD on, essentially. And ironically, I did it part-time because I was still competing as a high-level performer at that stage. I actually took a little bit of a break from it to take part in the UEFA Women's Champions League qualifying stage with UCD at the time. And it was that inequality that, I suppose, motivated me. But the more that I read sociology and understood all the work that's taken place around the world, the more that I also realized that I needed to temper my own sense of what was wrong and right. And if you like, try and suspend that when I was doing research. So try and keep an open mind, get as much of a balanced view as I could, and then, I suppose, re-immerse myself back into sport and policy and, you know, the different recommendations that we would make, armed with better knowledge. And that sometimes can be a very difficult process, because, you know, you'll come across things that you didn't necessarily think about before. You find your views are challenged a lot, which I think is a good thing. And it's what drew me to sociology, because I suppose I enjoy the process of reflection, and it's an important part of education. I mean, why else do we get into education, or pardon me, other than to learn? But we're in good company, Joanne. Did you know that there are four members of the current US women's national team who are sociology and social science graduates?
I heard that recently and I was laughing, because I was like to my mother, it proves that my 4 years wasn't for nothing.
Wasn't a waste. So Megan Rapinoe, Crystal Dunn, who was a left back, Abby Dalkemper, I think, who started all of the games at centre back, and Rose Lavelle are all sociology graduates. And it doesn't surprise me on some level, because of the ways in which they recognize that as a team, they're more than just a team, and that soccer, as they call it, is more than just a game as well, because I think they're very adept at leveraging their profile now to draw attention to important issues.
Do you think that, like, sociology, it in a way, it kind of makes you aware of why the reason that inequality is there? Like, there's no obvious answer when you kind of reflect on society and how it was built and how stereotypes were put in and labels and things like that. Do you think that's a big help in kind of entering into policy arguments, into entering, I suppose, any form of an argument when it comes to women in sport, that you're able to say, look, this is why it's there, but this is what has to change?
Yes, for sure. I think the one thing it's helped me, and I've been doing it, I suppose, maybe for 10 or 15 years now, but it's one of the things I try and get our new, you know, students coming into Ulster to begin to understand the world around them a little bit more, and to understand that there are connections between things that maybe we previously thought were disconnected. So I always, when it comes to women in sport, use the example, for instance, of the fact that women joined the civil service later than men. And when they joined at a certain point in their careers, they were forced to leave that job because it was a marriage bar at one stage. Mm-hmm. And that therefore inequalities in pay took quite some time to be reduced, because there was a legacy, if you like, of underdevelopment. And it's the same principle when you look at the ways in which most women's sports around the world lag behind those played by men, because there's been this historical legacy of underdevelopment, and it's going to take a long time to redress that, to come to what we might call equality.
Yeah, because even I remember saying it to a friend of mine, we're watching obviously the Women's World Cup, and he was saying, you know, geez, I thought the standard would be a little bit better, you know, considering it's involved in FIFA. And I'm like, but it's only been involved in FIFA for the last 8 tournaments. Like, if you think of the men's football and when, say, the 8th World Cup was held, that was way back in the 30s, you know. So, like, the difference there, I'm not saying we're equating it, because I think sometimes women's sport can kind of benefit from the stuff that's being done in men's sport, you know, with the crossovers and things like that. But, you know, I think a lot of it, we have to sit and look and be like, okay, need to understand it as a social context as well as an actual World Cup itself, do you think?
Yes, and as a social process, and it's ongoing, because it's only one, and it's been a tremendously important step in time for the current generation of women's football players and the coverage that it's got worldwide as well. But that's the very point, isn't it? It's only at this point in time. I mean, I'm struck in particular by some of the increasing standards in goalkeeping, for instance, because I followed the World Cups quite closely, and there's been a massive increase in the standard of goalkeeping, which of course is coming from greater investment. It's coming from this generation putting in place a standard of play that will force the next generation to achieve even higher standards.
Yeah, because even, wasn't it Hope Solo that was saying it, that the reason that it's a bit lower is because women's goalkeeping coaching isn't there, because it's not as developed as what it will be in the men's game.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's other stuff like height and goal size and things like that, but I think you kind of have to disregard those, because you do have to understand the social context of women and where, like, where that's come from.
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose, getting back to the notion of sociology, if it helps us to think about individually and collectively how much we invest ourselves in sport, and because we identify so closely with it, then we can recognize a lot of the benefits of sports participation, but sometimes some of the deeper issues don't always get the same focus precisely because of our loves for sport. So that's what I think, at least personally for me, what's helped me to understand sociology and sport in the round, is being able to take that step back a little bit and ask challenging questions, both of myself, but also of what's happening in sport. Now, that doesn't always sit well with people, because of course, you end up having conversations where you're maybe challenging the very values and beliefs that somebody else holds. Mm. And oftentimes we see that sport is placed either almost above or below politics. It's either not serious enough to warrant analysis, or it's meant to be above that, because it's the one realm of life where for, you know, 90 minutes or 70 minutes, whatever it might be, we suspend all normality. We turn into these crazed human beings that scream and shout and let out all of our emotions and tensions. And then when the game or the competition finishes, we return to normal life as well. And of course, that's not true either, because as you rightly say, sport reflects society. And actually, in some cases, it has particular dynamics of its own that are potentially more deviant than what happens in society. And we might, you know, we'll come to that in a few minutes, I'm sure, when it comes to the stuff around pain and injury.
Yeah, I was going to, because actually when you said that initially, my criminology mind flashed back to kind of, you know, an exaggeration of society, and deviant was actually kind of hooligans. Now, I know we're not going to fully talk about hooligans, but it was just kind of the first thing that popped into my head. It's like an expression of identity that turns into something more intense than an expression of identity.
Yes. And my PhD supervisor, I mean, one of the things that helped me very much in my research career, I was fortunate enough to be supervised by one of who was regarded as the kind of founding fathers. He was a male in this case, of the sociology of sport. Believe it or not, as a discipline, it probably really only emerged in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And in the 1980s, we know that there was a whole spate of what we call football hooliganism in the UK, particularly around the world, but mainly in the UK. He was one of the experts at the time who was charged with researching it and trying to understand. And that's the very point that he made, that in a sense, it wasn't just about football. It was an expression of particular kinds of masculinities in the UK that were being exacerbated by socioeconomic inequalities under the Thatcherite government.
I was actually joking with, I think it was Arena Buckley at the first interview, when I said to her that women in sport will be, it'll be fulfilled in my mind if I see some hooliganism. And she was laughing, and she was like, you want the flares in Croke Park? And I was like, I want all the flares. I want everything. I want everything to kind of go up. You're going back to your PhD, like, it took you on to a lot of things, and it was actually one of the first of its kind. I don't want to kind of focus in on it too much, but I think it's important to kind of recognize, like, the precedent that you set, I suppose. You know, it's unbelievable. Like, I mean, you had nothing really in a sense to go off of from an Irish context.
No, very little. Plenty in America. And that's probably not surprising given the ways in which women's sports began to have a greater profile in America, even if it was precisely because they challenged it rather than just its growing popularity. A little bit more in the UK. I mean, in many ways, when it comes to sports, sometimes I think some of the developments on the island of Ireland can lag a little bit behind the UK. You know, you can see 5 or 10 years later, there'll be a trend and a movement, whether it's in relation to coaching or the professionalization of certain sports. And that was the case for women in sport as well. So I had a blank slate for sure, Joanne. And it definitely caused me a lot of challenges, because when you've no parameter at all, I mean, I remember my supervisor saying to me, Katie, you need to stop now. You could continue to do this, but you have enough here for a PhD. And I suppose, I mean, I'm still studying sport. I've moved off into other aspects of identity, arguably. I mean, gender identity was what I started out with, but I'm still very passionate about it today, Joanne. Obviously, I mean, myself and Mary O'Connor have written a chapter for a forthcoming book about the 20 by 20 campaign and about certainly the changes that need to change, the changes that need to occur in mainstream media coverage of women in sport, because obviously the online stuff and like the work you're doing is very important, and it's helping a lot in terms of raising the profile of women in sport. But I think we still need to have some serious conversations about mainstream media, because that's where the real battleground is for, you know, for the profile of women's sports.
I remember my brother actually during the Women's World Cup, it was maybe like the group stage that he came into me, and he was like, "Oh, is that on?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, "It's annoying me because I haven't seen ads for it, so I can't take time out, you know, on my day." Because like my brother is that person that if he sees something's on at 2, he'll make time, you know, to watch it at 2 o'clock. But he was complaining because, you know, there wasn't enough ads, and I was kind of laughing. And I was like, "Well, Denny, you might have to be watching TV a bit more to kind of suss it out." And he was like, "That shouldn't be the case, Joanne. I should just hear about it."
I know. It should be easy, shouldn't it? Yeah, should just be at my fingertips, as it were. I mean, that's one of the downsides of social media, isn't it? Mm. You get these sound bites, and you sometimes get a kind of a simplistic approach to certain issues as well. But I mean, I'm glad that your podcast is going well, Joanne, and I'm really impressed by the way in which you're willing to think beyond sport and to take issues a little bit more seriously as well. So well done on that.
Ah, cheers. Thanks very much. I suppose, to be fair, it was, as I said, the precedent laid down by you. You know, I mean, I wasn't as airy-fairy going into it saying, "Oh, I'd love to do crime in sports and look at why sports is the way it is and things like that." You know, I actually had basis to go off of it. As I said, my mother wasn't giving out to me pretending I knew what I was doing. You know, your career, I suppose, it took you on like a massive journey. You know, you went to UCD, as you said, Chester, and now you're with obviously Ulster University, and you're focusing now on teaching and lecturing. And I suppose we did just touch there on sports and gender and identity and just a little bit. But I suppose my main, the reason why I wanted to talk to you more was we were kind of going to look at concussion, because I think concussion is a huge thing that's coming out these days. You know, we had Ryan McHugh, you know, talk about it when in the GAA. We had Orla Finn here in Cork talking about her, you know, kind of women in sport, kind of concussion experience. But I suppose just going back, the perception, I suppose, of concussion in Ireland at the moment, it's still a bit, we're still not sure. Like, nobody knows, you know. Like, how do we make sure that someone understands this is what a concussion, and feel a little bit sympathetic? Like, I remember when the Liverpool goalkeeper, Karius, you know, when he had his concussion, and a few boys, you know, that I would have trained in football saying, "Ah, that's only an excuse." Like, it's not an excuse, you know. So how do we change, you know, is that changing?
It's starting to change in the sense that the very fact that we're raising it means there's greater awareness of this particular injury, Joanne. But one of the reasons why it's so problematic is because it's essentially a hidden injury. So unlike most other sports-related injuries, where there is some kind of evident breakdown in the physiological function, and immediately you can see by the player or the athlete that something, you know, they're struggling physically. This is not necessarily the case with concussion, and even its very title can be misleading. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that I try to sensitize my students a lot to in terms of the language that we should begin to use around it, because as you'll know, most graduates that come out of sport are looking for a job in coaching or development and so on. And these future generations are going to be critical to carrying on this awareness journey around concussion. I mean, it's essentially brain shaking.
Yeah, because I was even thinking myself, like, it when you're looking at concussion, it's like there's three different like kind of categories. So it's like your medical category, your social category, and then your athlete category, you know, and the three, for some unknown reason, don't seem to mend together. Like, you have the medical side saying, "Well, this is what it is." Socially, you have everyone saying, "Ah, well, you know, you can't see it, so it can't be real." And then you have the athlete saying, "Well, I want to play on because that's my job," you know, more than anything else. Like,
Yeah. And I think we ignore the medical research at our peril, Joanne. I mean, I don't want to sound overly negative about this, but I do want to make the case that it is a life-threatening injury, that unlike most other sports-related injuries that we regard as, you know, part and parcel of sport, torn ligaments, potentially sometimes broken bones, torn muscles, so on and so forth, most of which, in fact, all of which now are very successfully treated. The higher up you go the chain in elite performance and, we, you know, with the advances in sports medicine. Mm-hmm. But concussion or brain shaking is very different. Either as a one-off or as a recurrent injury, it can be life-threatening, worst-case scenario. At best, it can cause, and it usually does cause, some level of cognitive impairment in some ways. But the challenge with this particular kind of injury is that those symptoms are delayed. They're highly individualized. So my expression of a brain-related shaking incident might be very different to yours, for instance, or I might exhibit it in different ways. And also then the return to train and play protocol has to be very carefully managed. It's the only injury, aside from blood injuries, that has a specific regulation now around the world. So you think about that in relation to most other injuries. And in fact, in some sports in particular, and rugby and NFL have been leading the way, they are in fact taking very specific interventions around this injury in its own right, such as its seriousness. And we have unfortunately had some deaths, and there is this impending cloud associated with the potential for long-term cognitive damage and some supposed links with CTE as well.
Thanks very much for listening to part one of my interview with Dr. Katie Liston. Tune in next week where we continue our conversation about concussion and everything that is involved in concussion in sport today. Cheerio.
The Big Red Bench.
Game on.
Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.